is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The violent extremist threat continues to grow. Since the junta took over in 2020, we've seen a 30% increase in the number of violent extremist attacks in Mali.
That's Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, on the growing tensions between Mali and France. Details are coming up. Also, thousands of additional police have been deployed in Cameroon's capital's Olimbi Stadium ahead of this evening's semi-final match between Egypt and Cameroon. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Mali has asked France for a review of bilateral defense agreements amid growing tensions between Paris and the ruling junta in Bamako. Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop said Bamako has submitted suggested amendments to Paris. The ruling junta in Mali ordered the French ambassador to leave the country. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi whether such actions would contribute to more tensions between the two sides.
Clearly, asking the ambassador of a bilateral partner to leave signals a serious strain in the relationship. And I think this move needs to be understood as not something linked to anything in particular the French have done, but reflects a broader posturing, mostly for a domestic audience by the junta. It's trying to play up different national and populist sentiments in Mali to generate popular support for itself and obscure the fact that the junta itself is illegitimate and is really aiming to try and hold on to power indefinitely. So using the anti-colonial card is a surefire way to generate popular support. I think we need to keep in mind, too, that these moves by the junta are taking place in a context where they've recently rejected the arrival of additional 100 Danish forces. They rejected the offer to send additional 2,000 EU-supported troops to the MINUSMA peacekeeping operation. And all the while, the violent extremist threat continues to grow. Since the junta took over in 2020, we've seen a 30% increase in the number of violent extremist attacks in Mali.
Relations between the two countries have deteriorated sharply since Mali's army staged a coup in August 2020 and after failing to organize an election following a second military coup last May. Mali's military proposed instead to stay in power for up to 5 years before staging elections, despite international demands that the junta should respect its promise to hold the vote in February. What could the international community do to undo the military takeover in Mali?
I think there are several things it can do. I think most importantly, it should not recognize the junta as the sovereign representative of the state of Mali. The junta is simply a faction of the military, of mid-level officers who decided to seize power. They lack legitimacy. They're operating outside of a constitutional framework, and they have resisted attempts and their own prior agreements to transition back to a democratic system. You know, it reveals that their real motives are to hang on to power indefinitely. The other thing that the international community can do is support ECOWAS in their effort to isolate the junta. They've imposed sanctions. They've closed borders. I think the international democratic community needs to rally behind ECOWAS and really pressure the junta to turn power over to an interim administration who can then hold elections and restore a legitimate government to Mali. I think that pressure can be enhanced by denying the junta access to sovereign accounts of the country. And I think it would also underscore that the junta really is in a weak position politically, economically. It needs regional international support in order to survive and as well as to address the security needs that Mali is facing. I think it's for these reasons that junta is trying to stir up domestic passions through its populist anti-colonialist messages as a means of trying to prop itself up.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawi. 26 people have died after lightning struck a high-tension power cable on the outskirts of Kinshasa, causing it to snap and fall on houses and a market. Leaders of the West African Regional Economic Bloc, ECOWAS, are meeting today in Ghana to discuss the growing political instability among some member states, including Tuesday's failed coup attempt in Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Bissau's President Umaro Sissoko Embalo, a former army general, said the attack during a government meeting was well prepared and organized and could be related to people involved in drug trafficking. The military coup in neighboring Burkina Faso on January 24th is expected to be the primary focus of the ECOWAS meeting. The 15-nation West African group suspended Burkina Faso last week after mutinous soldiers ousted democratically elected President Roch Marc Christian Kabore, citing his inability to stem jihadist violence. Burkina Faso is the third nation suspended by the regional bloc after Mali and Guinea to be punished for military takeovers in a year and a half. And Nigerian authorities say an oil production, storage, and offloading ship has exploded in southern Delta State and that 10 crew members are feared dead. Lawmakers shared their apprehensions about Tunisia's trajectory and pressed the Biden administration to continue to support transparent and meaningful reforms and accountability for President Kais Saied's plans. The Biden administration pledged that democracy and human rights will be the core of its foreign policy. Reporter Angie Omar discussed with Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, the result of the U.S. pressure on the Tunisian president.
I think that both Congress and the Biden administration have made it very clear and have stated repeatedly their support for democracy in Tunisia and their desire to see democracy restored in Tunisia. As you know, Tunisia was the only democracy in the Arab world for the past 10 years, following the revolution of 2011. However, the coup against democracy and against the constitution organized by President Kais Saied on July 25 put an end to democracy in Tunisia because Kais Saied has grabbed all the powers and is demolishing all the institutions of democracy in the country. So I think now Congress and the Biden administration must find a way to do more for Tunisia, more to support democracy restoration in Tunisia, more than just issuing statements, because they've issued a lot of statements in the past 6 months. But President Kais Saied so far has refused to listen to their requests or their urgings to restore democracy.
Transparency International's annual report on the Global Corruption Perceptions Index described Tunisia as an unfortunate example and explained that it could lose its democratic gains, stressing that recent political measures taken by President Kais Saied have weakened the control and accountability systems and that they have caused an increase in public fear of reporting corruption. What is your take on that?
President Kais Saied actually was elected in 2019 on the premise and the promise that he is Mr. Clean and that he will do everything he can to fight against corruption. And that is why he was elected. And then he repeated this promise during his coup of July 25, that he organized this coup or this power grab on July 25 because he wanted to fight against corruption. But again, it's ironic and it's very disappointing that the only thing he has done so far in his 2 years of presidency and 6 months after the coup, after grabbing all the powers, The only thing he has done is to shut down the constitutionally mandated independent agency to fight against corruption, which is called INLUCC, INLUCC. And he fired all its employees. This is the National Agency for Fighting Against Corruption, which has collected thousands and thousands of cases of corruption, and it was investigating these cases. But now we don't even know what happened to those files, or even if they are still there, because the commission or the agency has been closed for 6 months. We don't even know what happened to those files. Similarly, the agency mandate also included the protection of people who reported cases of corruption. But now, since the agency was closed down, there is no protection being offered. So people are going to be reluctant to report new cases. The coup of ISIS-Saied has failed, you know, miserably in every way, including in improving the economy and the economic conditions of most Tunisians. We have had inflation of almost 50% in the last 6 months, and also, unfortunately, in fighting corruption.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, speaking with reporter Angie Omar. In South Africa, a top provincial politician was shot dead after a string of assassinations of political figures, mostly in KwaZulu-Natal province in recent years. An inquiry into the violence a few years ago concluded that a lot of the shootings were linked to competition for multi-million dollar contracts for government projects. Darren Taylor reports.
From 2015 to 2018, a commission of inquiry led by advocate Marumo Mwerane investigated a wave of killings of political office bearers in KwaZulu-Natal. Even as he and his colleagues were hearing evidence of hit squads hired by politicians to kill rivals, the deaths continue to mount, and they still do. The latest to fall is a leading member of the Inkatha Freedom Party, the IFP, Reggie Ndima.
He was arriving at home and unknown assailants actually opened fire on him as was arriving at home and then sped off. The family, of course, was present, and the neighbors who heard the very loud shower of gunshots which were directed in his way.
IFP spokesperson Mkuleko Hlengwa says Ndima was also speaker of the municipal council in the KwaZulu-Natal town of Newcastle. His killing follows that of a ward councillor for the African National Congress, the ANC, in the municipality of eThekwini. Hlengwa says it's deeply concerning that the police aren't charging people for all the recent killings of officials from the two dominant parties in the province.
The climate of fear will continue to escalate if the police continue to fail. This failure sits squarely at the doorstep of the law enforcement agencies. And it is totally unacceptable that people are losing lives day in and day out when they are servants of the people. And an institution of the state, such as the police, is anchored in a laissez-faire attitude in dealing with these matters.
The police say they're investigating, but that the fear which Hlengwa speaks of means people who could provide positive leads aren't speaking. Hlengwa responds that all the police have to do is look at who stands to gain the most from each particular killing.
It does not bode well for democracy, it does not bode well for stability, good governance and service delivery to have public representatives who are conducting their work and duty, and every material point have to keep on looking over their shoulders. Therefore, it is important that the law enforcement agencies do their job so that it can act as a security for councillors, in particular in them doing their job.
Violence monitors say KwaZulu-Natal remains awash with weapons dating back to the late 1980s and early 1990s. That's a period when the ANC and IFP fought each other for dominance in the province in the years leading up to South Africa's first democratic elections in 1994. So the hitmen have easy access to automatic rifles such as AK-47s. Hlengwa says it's incredible that after so many years, law enforcement still hasn't managed to find and confiscate the guns. He believes killings in recent years are motivated more by access to public money via state contracts than politics.
In the absence of successful prosecutions of people who are stealing public funds, they're going to continue looting and they're going to continue on a killing spree to push aside those standing in their way. It is an absolute imperative that the law enforcement agencies step up to the occasion of doing their job.
Klengwa agrees that at the root of it all is the failure of political parties, including his own, to ensure that all of their office bearers are people of integrity. Too many people from both the IFP and the ANC are stealing, he says, with greed driving the body count up by the week. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Mali has long been known for its music, dance and cultural festivals despite the ongoing insurgency that has halted most tourism. Two military coups since 2020 and delayed elections led West African nations to impose economic sanctions against Mali, which Europe has supported. But as the festival season kicks off, participants and organizers are still finding reasons to sing and dance. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Veronique Jainan Lou is an interpretive dancer from Ivory Coast living in Niger. Lou was invited to Mali's Fardi Foni Wati dance festival this year, arriving by bus on January 9th. That same day, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, imposed travel and economic sanctions on Mali, closing land and air borders between Mali and its West African neighbors. Lou is unsure of how exactly she will get home to Niger. In the meantime, she performed as part of a group dance piece in an auditorium at the Blamba Cultural Center, packed with adults and neighborhood children alike. She says she found a festive atmosphere in the country, despite the sanctions. People aren't even worried about that, she says. The government, they work for themselves, and we the artists, we are doing our thing. We are just one voice. We're the voice of the people. We don't know when all of these problems will be solved, so we are doing our activities, and we continue our party. Before the 2012 takeover of northern Mali by Islamist militants, the country was known for its cultural festivals, which were a frequent attraction for tourists. But these festivals have always been popular with Malians, and even though tourism has nearly ground to a halt, the festivals have, for the most part, continued. New festivals have popped up in the years since unrest began. The Ogabanya Festival is a week-long Dogon cultural festival held on the Niger riverbank in Bamako in its seventh year. Amasago Dunyon is the president of the organizing committee of the festival, which he hopes can be a place for people to unwind. There has been this embargo, he says. There has been worry of what will we do tomorrow. Culture is a neutral means of expression. No one is afraid to come here because it's a place of culture, a place of exchange, a place of dialogue. And this is the best kind of place for people to gather, to talk, and to de-stress. The Fardi Foni Wati Festival depends on participants who come from other countries in the West African region, as well as Europe, to perform original dance pieces alongside Malian performers. Drissa Samake, the managing director of the Blamba Center, says that even though many participants could not make it to Bamako this year because of the travel embargo, calling off the festival was never an option. He says that it's during times when the country is facing crises that it's even more important to hold these cultural activities. He says, nothing can unite so many people during this period like these cultural events. It's important to us to strengthen this sector that allows us to create what we call social cohesion. The festival on the Niger will be held next weekend in Segu, Mali, and Festival Agna in Kolikoro takes place later in February. Both will bring together musicians from around the country. How Mali's current political situation will progress remains to be seen, but music and dancing is sure to continue. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Cameroon has deployed thousands of additional police to the capital's Olympic Stadium ahead of Thursday evening's Africa Football Cup of Nations semifinal between Egypt and Cameroon. The stadium was suspended last week from hosting games after a football fan stampede overpowered security and killed 8 people. The suspension was lifted Sunday after Cameroonian authorities assured the Confederation of African Football of additional security measures. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Pressure is mounting by the day as football fans prepare to watch teams participating in the Africa Football Cup of Nations matches, says the local AFCON organizing committee. Cameroon said Thursday that close to 70,000 football fans want to watch the AFCON semi-final clash between the Indomitable Lions of Cameroon and the Pharaohs of Egypt at Yaoundé's 60,000-seat Olympe Stadium. Cameroon's Ministry of Sports and Physical Education says about 3,000 of the 70,000 fans who are pressing to watch the match are supporters of the Pharaohs of Egypt. The others support the Indomitable Lions of Cameroon. Nasseri Paul Beya, governor of Cameroon's Central Region, where Yaoundé's Olympe Stadium is located, says the government has mobilized 2,000 police officers to ensure the security and safety of football players, fans, and match officials taking part in the games.
People who come 1 hour to the match will not be allowed entering into the field, and we would like them to make their corona tests before they come to the field, so that when you come with your test results, they'll just give you a pass and you make entering into the field more fluid and more elegant. We are calling on this population to collaborate because CAF has said that there will be zero tolerance, and so we want them to understand that it is the image of our country.
Beya said tickets to the Cameroon-Egypt match will not be sold at the Olympe Stadium. He said many ways to enter the stadium will be opened to ensure the safety of fans, players, and match officials. During the first matches of the tournament played at Olympe, only one gate was opened, making access to the stadium very difficult for the 57,000 fans who attended the match. Beya said 7 additional gates will be opened during the match between Cameroon and Egypt on Thursday. Last week, CAF suspended AFCON matches at the Olympe Stadium after a crush killed 8 and wounded 38 people. The crush happened as crowds struggled to gain access to the stadium as Cameroon beat Comoros 2-1 to reach the quarterfinals. On Sunday, CAF said that taking note of undertakings from Cameroon to assure the safety of football fans, players, and match officials, it unanimously agreed to lift the suspension imposed on the Olympe Stadium. CAF said it would allow one AFCON semifinal game to take place in the Olympe Stadium, and that if security is still threatened, the stadium will again be suspended. Funi Clifford, spokesperson of the Association of Supporters of the Indomitable Lions, says fans should stop behavior that jeopardizes safety of others, such as jumping the stadium fence if they do not have negative COVID-19 results or tickets.
We as citizens, we equally need to be responsible when going to the stadium. If each and every person take responsibilities in their hands, I think we will not come close to anything like what I saw at Olympia last Monday.
The CAF said for security reasons and to curb the spread of COVID-19, a maximum of 45,000 fans will be authorized to watch the match at the 60,000-seat Olympe Stadium. Cameroon's police said in a statement that they plan to ensure only 45,000 fans are admitted into the stadium as requested by CAF, and that the 2,000 police deployed will not tolerate dangerous behavior from spectators. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé. Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abbaro, thank you again for tuning in.